Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Who is January Jones? She is not a young, beautiful, talented actress on Mad Men. She is not an older, gorgeous, exotic dancer from the Johnny Carson Show. She is an author, and she wrote Thou Shall Not Wine, the 11th Commandment, that reached number one at Amazon.com. She is a reality TV golf personality with World High Stakes Golf televised on HDNet. She is a humorist and winologist expert. She is your featured host today on January Jones Sharing Success Stories. So sit back, relax, and get ready to laugh and listen to Ms. Jones with her eclectic roster of guests as you learn life's lessons. These stories plus sharing equals success. Welcome, and remember, beware, because you are entering the no-whining world of January Jones.
Now let me ask you a question. Have you ever heard about someone who is passionate about living the life you love? Would you like to learn more about what it's like to date when you're a famous celebrity? Have you ever wanted to know about being both raw and delicious at the same time? Tell me. Can you imagine what it's like being a personal strategist? Do you know what it's like to dump his ass? That's right. Dump his ass. Use those Mr. Wrongs to lead you straight to Mr. Right. And when was the last time you heard about a strategic guide for the stars? Now, we're talking about the stars in Hollywood, not the stars in heaven. Or better yet, would you like to meet someone who has some of the answers that we're looking for today? Now, are you ready to learn how to be successful? If you can answer yes or maybe to any of these questions, then you are in the right place. And I would like to welcome you to January Jones Sharing Success Stories. Today I will be introducing you to my guest. She has been on the show before, and she is a success coach extraordinaire. She will provide us with wonderful, informative, and inspirational lessons and some really, really great advice. I'm pleased to announce that our show now has over 1.6 million listeners to date. Also, LinkedIn has announced that my profile was one of the top 5% most viewed during 2012. Now, let me tell you a little bit about our guest today. To say she is passionate about living the life you love is without question an understatement. With a personal story, she has a perspective to navigating life. She's a trauma survivor who used her own instincts to transform virtually others, but she couldn't transform herself. Sought out by high-profile clientele that extend from the west coast of California, her celebrity clients, she excels at finding the deepest hidden causes for glitches in life and love so you get immediate results and rid of any baggage. She has appeared on countless radio shows and TV networks. She's a member of the Screen Actors Guild, who still loves to act theatrically. And her newest book, How to Date When You're Famous, just came out. I'm pleased to welcome back to our show the wonderful Charlie Emery. Hi, Charlie. How are you doing today?
Hey, January. I'm fantastic. It's so great to be here with you tonight.
Oh, I've been looking forward to having you back on the show. You certainly have been a busy, busy gal since the last time we had you on the show. Tell us what you've been up to lately.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, my brand new book, How to Date When You're Famous, A Strategic Guide for the Stars, just came out today. It's available on Kindle, and I'm really excited about it.
Oh, wonderful.
It was inspired by some of my celebrity clients that came to me, and, you know, they come for me for a lot of different things, but in particular, I kind of got excited about just this love advice that I was giving in the dating. I thought, about this. I could do a really great manual based on all the stuff that I'm always working on with them and say, okay, here's some of the basic, the most common things, you know, that get mm-hmm. in the way.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And that happens no matter whether you're a celebrity or just a regular personality. Tell us a little bit before we talk about both of your wonderful, wonderful books, what it was like for you growing up and some of the things that were problems for you on your road to success.
You know, that's probably what surprises people the most, because they always see me smiling and they kind of think, oh, her life has just been a charm, you know. And most people are shocked when they discover that by age 19, I had endured 2 incidences of rape and battled an eating disorder, which I was still in the process of. And I went on to repress those traumas for another 7 years. And that came after already enduring a tremendous amount of prejudice, because when I grew up, we were the only multiracial family in town. I was born right in the city of Boston, and we had our issues there. And then we moved out into the suburbs, and, you know, that's where I ended up spending all of my school years. But in the beginning, it was pretty rough, and people wanted us to know that we were not welcome.
Oh, really?
So we had things like, you know, our car, I'll never forget coming out and, you know, having a car spray painted with racial slurs on it, and then your dad has to drive you to school in that, and because it's too early to go to a hardware store back then. You know, they didn't have hardware stores open at 7 in the morning. That was on the East Coast back in the early 70s, you know. So if something like that happened, you had to grin and bear it. So those were some tough, tough memories.
So when you were, how old were you when you realized that your parents' interracial marriage was different from most people that you were around?
I would say I was a toddler, because as a child, I was highly intuitive. And, you know, children have that sense anyway. And one of the things that would happen is that, you know, my mom was the one who was darker skin and my dad is German and Swedish. So what would happen is when I was out with my mom in the baby carriage, I would feel the negativity sometimes coming from people. At that time, it was coming from people of color, where they would look and say, well, you know, this child is clearly the child of, you know, a Caucasian man. And they would say things to my mom about what I didn't look like. And so I started picking up on that as a child in the city of Boston. So it was something that I can't remember a time when I didn't see it.
Now, what was it like when you went to school? What did your parents tell you? How did they explain their interracial relationship to you as a young child?
You know, the best part about my parents is they never focused on that. They knew that we endured a lot, but what was fantastic is they always said, you know, the bottom line is, there's always going to be a reason why someone may choose to pick on you. And it could be because of how tall you are, or how short they think you are, or because you're wearing glasses, or because they think you're overweight. So they really minimize that. I think that that was probably the biggest gift they gave us. They didn't want us to be angry and bitter. And they knew that there was no reason for us to be, because the reality is people go through similar things for all kinds of different reasons. And so they just said, don't look for it, but when it happens, don't take it on like it's, you know, it's your burden to carry for the rest of your life, because if it's not this, it could have been something completely different, even if this was not your reality, that, you know, you're the child of an interracial marriage. And that's what people are looking at.
How about your extended family? Were they understanding, your mothers, brothers and sisters, cousins and different relatives from both sides of the family? Were they supportive?
No, not really.
No.
You know what's interesting?
Well,
what's interesting is I barely had any extended family. I had one uncle who kind of came in and out a little bit, and he was cool. I mean, he didn't have any issue with race or anything like that. He just kind of had his own life and, you know, was kind of on his own path. I had one grandparent, which was my mom's mother, was my grandmother, and she was just amazing and wonderful. But the rest of the family on her side did not like the fact that my mother had married my father. So they projected stuff onto us, like we thought we were better and we were snobby and all that kind of stuff. So it's really funny to see all the different things that people make up based on their own issues. And that was one thing that as a child I did see. So it was like that whole side of the family was gone except for my grandmother, and then every so often my uncle coming through. And then on my dad's side, they disowned him.
Oh, really?
Found out he was with me. Oh, yes. Before he even married my mother, they said, you're literally dead to us. And that was it. Never, never met them. They would never have anything to do with us. And basically, it was many, many years later. In fact, it was just about 3 years ago that I met my dad's older brother who had, you know, he had been gone when my dad was growing up because he was a lot older. And I got to meet him for the first time because he, of course, didn't harbor any of those feelings and he didn't know where my dad was. So that was kind of a neat thing to reconnect and meet him in Santa Fe and sit down and have a margarita together, you know.
Long, long overdue. Tell me, how did your parents meet each other?
They met at a party, like a very small gathering at somebody's house. And my mom says that she called over that night, and it was a place where she used to hang out, you know, just friends. And she said, oh, who's over there tonight? And they went down the list, and they said, oh, and there's this guy here named Andy. And my mom said she got this weird feeling when she heard Andy. And so she had to go check him out, you know. And my dad was a musician. He used to teach at Berklee College of Music. He's a pretty awesome guy. And so he told her that night, you're going to marry, I'm going to marry you. And my mom
said,
crazy. And here they are, you know, over 40 years later, they're still like really, really close. So it's pretty awesome.
Oh, that's fantastic. So that was definitely love at first sight. I love hearing stories like that. What came first, now this eating disorder or the two incidents of rape?
Well, the eating disorder started because I was studying classical ballet. I studied classical ballet, jazz, modern, and tap from the time I was about 4 or 5 years old. And when I got to puberty, you know, started to hit puberty, that's when my body kind of changed a little bit. And they always loved me because I was petite, but I had the really long arms and long legs, which is perfect for a dancer. But I'm also have more of an athletic build. And so that, you know, they really like you to have that kind of skinny as a rail, especially back then in Massachusetts. You know, the whole Boston ballet scene was very, very strict about how you looked. And so as soon as my body started to change, I really didn't look at it initially as an eating disorder because I was so, I was always wanting to be, you know, that perfect student and do everything right. Because, you know, when you're growing up and people are prejudiced and stuff, you feel like you kind of already have a mark against you. So you think, okay, I got to do everything else right so they don't think, you know, they don't see this crack here that there's something wrong with me. So with my teacher, you know, back then it was just normal. I mean, she used to slap me in class and say, you're getting fat, what are you eating? And of course, thinking, oh, yeah, this is hardcore. I mean, when you're studying to possibly be a prima ballerina, there is absolutely no slack. It's not like your average dance school where everybody says, oh, you know, it doesn't matter if she points her toe. It's like everything needed to be. And she was my instructor was a former Russian prima ballerina. And so I just started doing all these things trying to manipulate my body because I would panic, and I would panic if I so much as ate, you know, a little fun-sized candy bar. It was like, so it was tough. Yeah. And once I stopped dancing, that's when it really became a problem because, of course, then my weight started going up because I went from doing 6 to 7 day a week rehearsal times to after a knee injury, which, you know, probably came from being a little malnourished at that time and working my body too hard. And so I stopped dancing when I was about 16 and a half, and all of a sudden my weight started going up, and it was just, it was a battle.
Oh, my gosh. You know, that's interesting that the injury is what had you stop your career. Some things like that are so unexpected, and yet your whole life changes. You know, Charlie, we're going to take a break and hear about your host. And when we come back, I want to talk some more about your eating disorder and how you dealt with the rape situation. We'll be right back with Charlie Emery.
Have you ever met someone who was unforgettable? Someone who touched your heart and soul? People who have faced difficult problems. People who have fearlessly shared their story. People who have priceless personalities. I've been fortunate to host a talk show, and it's been my privilege to interview hundreds of guests. They've shared their stories, their struggles, their secrets, and their successes. In my new ebook, We're talking about people dealing with incest, molestation, runaway kids, child abuse, drug abuse, polygamy, scandals, and starting over. Then there are my guests dealing with difficult physical struggles such as blindness, cancer, and birth defects. All of them have been exciting, eclectic, and energizing. They've amazed, amused, and even astonished me. I have adored getting to meet them and look forward to sharing them with you in my new ebook. Now you can go to Amazon.com to get your introductory offer of Priceless Personalities, Success Stories Shared by January Jones for only $4.99. Do it today.
Well, you know, Charlie, just like you, I'm very excited about my ebook, and you certainly are a priceless personality, and I look forward to sharing your interview in one of my future volumes. We were talking before the break about your eating disorder and that you put on an extra 50 pounds. How did you lose that weight?
Well, the 50 pounds was over, it was over a period of years. And what happened was with the eating disorder, I was just kind of, I just was yo-yoing, you know, back and forth. And what actually stopped me with that is that my friends at the time caught me. I was not a full bulimic and I was not an anorexic, but I kind of had my own little version of that, which was, you know, eating little amounts. And if every so often I would binge a little bit, but the main thing was that if I felt like I ate something I shouldn't have in my body, it didn't matter if my body was completely empty, I needed to get rid of it.
Okay.
And so it was pretty harsh on me. And one of my friends one day heard me, and I was so mortified that somebody would find out, you know, that, that this very, very private thing was happening, that I literally just started using this, well, like, you have to stop. You just have to stop. And I remember it was, you know, tough to, at first to get the weight. So my weight continued to yo-yo after that, but at least I stopped with any more of the making myself sick, which was great.
Yeah, yeah, that was a healthy thing to do. Now, you had two incidences of rape. Did this happen when you have left home and gone to college?
Yes, the first time happened when I was in my first semester of my sophomore year of college. And you know, I went to Clark University. I absolutely loved it. It's where I wanted to go. And ironically, when I was choosing that campus, my dad said that he had a really bad feeling about it. And I found that out from my mother. He never told me because I loved the campus so much. And that kind of played into things because after I was assaulted, I tried to keep it a secret and not tell anybody and not have it affect me. And by the time I got to the end of that first semester, I was absolutely living in fear and just had to go. And what I ended up doing was convincing my parents to let me leave school and get a leave of absence. And, I mean, I made such an airtight case that, you know, my dad said, are you sure you don't want to go to law school? It was that compelling of an argument. So when I left school.
So you didn't tell them about the rape?
Never told them at that time, no. I kept the whole
gosh.
Thing a secret. I just remembered, you know, I used to see, I could remember seeing on an interview once this woman on television, you know, and it was like a PM magazine show or something. And I just remember she was crying and she was so angry and she was saying, my life will never be the same. And I remember after it happened to me, having that image in my mind and thinking, I can't have that be me. I can't have that be me, you know? And so in this desire to have control over it, I didn't realize that I was giving it full control over my whole life. And I remember, you know, packing up everything in my apartment during winter break and feeling this surge that, you know, that I was victorious. And it wasn't until my dad and I got onto the exit, the entrance ramp onto the freeway to head home that all of a sudden the adrenaline just shot through my body and it was like the reality hit of what I had just done. That I had just this school that I worked so hard to get in. You know, I got in early decision. It was the only school I even applied for because it was my dream school, and I got, you know, early decision acceptance. And here I was leaving it.
Oh, my gosh. What a traumatic experience. And at what point did you reveal to your parents what really had happened to you?
Well, it was years later because what happened is I went back home. I got a job. I was waitressing. I was just trying to figure out what to do. I started, you know, putting in transfers to other schools, but mentally I just wasn't there. And that summer, a friend of mine from high school said, come on out and get a couple days off and come down to Cape Cod, because that's what a lot of people used to do, and they'd go down and they'd rent a house and work. And so I went down to see her for a couple of days, and she had a friend who got us into this club, and we were underage. And at that point, you know, I was really just disconnected from everything, and I drank too much. And I begged her not to leave me, because she said, oh, you know, there's a bouncer at the door and he thinks you're cute. And I just, none of it was adding up to me, and I didn't feel good about it. And I said, I've had too much to drink, just take me home. And she did not mean it, but she left because she wanted to go to the beach with her boyfriend. And the rest was history. And that was a much more violent situation. And after that is when I just checked out and repressed both of those traumas for about 7 years.
Oh, my gosh, 7 years. Wow, that is quite a story that you're sharing. So you've really been in the trenches.
that's where all the weight really started coming on, because I was so sad. You know, a lot of times when we go through something like this, there's two ways, you know, two extremes. Either we hide, or you tend to become very promiscuous and not respect your body, because in both scenarios, you tend to feel like you're broken and you're tainted. And in my scenario, I was very fortunate. I ended up getting married to someone who was very sweet and very kind. We were basically like brother and sister, but we had a very loving partnership. So I had a place where I was safe physically, but at the same time, I was so incredibly depressed that that's where I just started putting the weight on and weight on, and it was taking the weight off. And you asked how, and I basically, I gave myself permission one day to go to a weight loss clinic and took it off. Because, you know, I was in a store and I saw someone who I knew would recognize me from when I waitressed when I was in college. And here I was, like, it just didn't even look like myself. And I thought, I cannot bear to see the look in her eye when she, I'll be able to tell that she's going to be looking at me saying, what happened to her? And I couldn't bear it. So I went to run away from her and almost ran into a plate glass mirror. And that's when I realized what I looked like to me in my own eyes. You know, I saw that shame, and I said, okay, there's a lot going on here, but the first thing that you can do is take this weight off, and you need help. So I just went to a clinic, and they put me on, like, a, you know, a set diet, and I said, I won't cheat. Give me the food. I won't cheat. And all the weight came off. And there you go. And so the weight came off.
So you've been lost, and how did you come to realize that you are more than your experiences? Did you have a breakthrough, or how did it evolve? I'm sure that being in a marriage where you were married to your best friend was very helpful.
You know, I mean, we were very friendly, but there was just this whole part of me that he would never relate to if he even knew it. So it was really interesting. What happened is when that weight came off, I started to just experience life in a whole new way. And it was about 6 months later that all the memories resurfaced. And when they did, you know, I realized everything in my life is a lie and I have to change it. And yet I felt so bad. That was when I could finally recognize that those experiences had owned me instead of me owning them. And I just came clean and told everybody, here's what happened. And
oh my gosh.
So just understanding that that's what had enabled me to do that, and I remembered that I told myself I could no longer be me and have the life I was going to have, and that was really the key to my whole, like, okay, I get it, because once I made sense of why I had done what I had done, I knew I was not going to waste any more time being upset about it. It was time, and I also realized in that moment, the insight was, wait a minute. This is not actually about what happened to me. It's about what I decided about my life and myself after it happened. That's what created all the issues.
So that you came to this realization on your own. It's my you didn't go to therapy. You figured this all out by yourself.
Yes, I figured that out by myself, and then I actually called a couple of therapists hoping that they would be really excited and fascinated by what I discovered and just give me like an hour or two like I do with my clients to really say, okay, what else do we need to look for? And they wouldn't. They said, that's impossible. You can't do something like that. And I went, what are you talking about? And so, of course, after putting that kind of a limitation on me for 7 years, there was no way I was going to let somebody else do it. So I said, okay, well, then I guess I have to just keep on this journey by myself.
Good for you. Good for you. Now, when did you write your book? Thank goodness you dumped his ass. You so Mr. Wrong should lead you straight to Mr. Right. I've read your book.
Yes.
I love your book. I recommended it to so many young women. What prompted you to write that book?
A divorce.
Okay.
No, I shouldn't even say that. It was really more than that. It was excitement again about relationships. And I know that a lot of people out there, you know, they go, well, listen to all this stuff she's talking about. But, you know, we always break things down into success and failure. And the thing that I learned is that my greatest successes came from the corrections I was making. And I saw that those very things that I looked at as being flaws, that those were the things that united me with other people. So I love to recycle. That's my passion. And I wrote Thank Goodness You Dumped His Ass to recycle a relationship that was actually in a lot of ways very, very good. But unfortunately, because he wasn't as emotionally mature and stuff as I was, even though we had an amicable split, the divorce was really awful. And I was like, oh, my gosh. And I didn't participate in that part of it. I wrote a book instead because I was trying to keep my sanity and make sense of how did I end up married to someone who would behave like this? You know what I mean? Like you say, okay, we have our differences, but why would he behave like this? And so in writing that, I knew what I already needed to do that I hadn't done before I met him. He swept me off my feet. It was total romance. I didn't even have a chance to think about anything with him, and I wasn't even looking for a boyfriend when I met him. So I wanted to include one side, that strategic side. How do you position yourself to attract a fabulous relationship, and what kinds of things do you need to be thinking about and be aware of prior to even beginning to date? So that's part of the book. The other half of the book was inspired by that anger I felt over how he was acting, and I knew, okay, what was my role just in bringing him into my life, and how do I recycle this? And so it's about being able to look at the pieces and the things that you've already gone through and pick up all the gems so that you can bounce the rest of the curb, and number one, most important, you don't feel like you wasted your time because you extract the value, and there's always value.
Oh, this is fascinating. And you actually teach people how to trade the concept of self-love for the action of loving you first. And that's a difficult thing for people to do, isn't it?
Well, you know what's funny? People don't have as much of a problem with it, but I find a lot of times when I talk to someone who's like really big into self-help and that just happens to be one of their favorite phrases, they just, they're like, don't tell them to take out self-love. And I'm like, no, we're transitioning here because see what, one of the things that I always noticed, and I noticed it with me first, was that lots of times the concept of self-love, it is a concept. But people don't know how to apply it in their lives as an action. So you can have this amazing conversation, and then you don't see it anywhere in their lives. So for me, everything is about action because it's the fastest way to make a shift is for you to incorporate it as an action right away. It's no different than learning a language. If you don't practice it, you forget it, right? With self-love, if we start looking at self-love instead of like something that we should want and feel and all of that and say, no, it's something that we should do. It needs to show up in how we treat ourselves and what we teach other people about ourselves, in the kinds of friends we're attracting and the boundaries we're setting. That is called loving you first. So I love that because then it really makes sure that people are making sure that their choices and actions are actually aligned with creating the kinds of results and experiences that they want the most.
Okay, and now you're encouraging people to change their pattern, and you're encouraging them to do it quickly. You know, we're going to take a break now and have another commercial, and when we come back, I want to talk to you about what it's like to be a personal strategist and what it's like dealing with celebrities. We'll be right back with Charlie Emery.
Could your commute or daily exercise routine use a boost? When was the last time you really got the giggles? June is audiobook month, and the producers of Yikes, another quirky audiobook, invite you to tune in, turn on, and let loose a few good laughs. Yikes, another quirky audiobook, is about a marijuana enthusiast named Blue McKenna who gets involved in a reality TV show as a way to cure an apocalyptic case of writer's block. A conglomerate of kooky contestants invades the polygamous community of Naval, Utah to compete in a reality show called Yikes. Things get sticky when Blue McKenna's hemp garden is ignited during an ill-fated seance. Find out what's going down in the desert in Yikes, another quirky audiobook. This is Adele Park inviting you to celebrate Audiobook Month on the funny side. Visit www.yikesaudiobook.com. That's www.yikesaudiobook.com.
Welcome back with my guest, Charlie Emery. Now, Charlie, tell us exactly what you do as a personal strategist.
One of my favorite things. Well, people come to me, of course. I'm all about, like, you know, living the life you love. And so as somebody who was a trauma survivor, I have an emphasis on getting to the root of exactly what it is that's causing people to see glitches between what they want to experience and what they are experiencing. Or if they are experiencing what they want and they're feeling, you know, their feelings aren't matching up, like they feel guilty, they feel depressed, and they're saying, my life is amazing, what is going on? I've got to find those things. So really people bring me in to pinpoint what are those causes, what are the unspoken rules and beliefs that are actually driving a person, even if they're in complete conflict with what they think they believe about what they're doing.
Okay. Now, what surprises you the most about people when they come to you?
Well, I would say I don't know if I could say what surprises me the most, because these are all things that I went through with me. So it's really more of an exciting thing where, you know, I love to see them come in and say, really, we're going to be able to figure this out. And then we see it and there's just this total shift. I think the biggest thing is in removing the mystery, because so much of self-help and therapy, it's wonderful, but there's so much exploration that often people are left with a lot of mystery, and so they don't really understand. And the biggest thing for me coming through what I went through was wanting to remove that mystery and really get a handle on exactly why I did what I did, so that I knew I could not only shift it, but I would have that much more personal power going forward. And so, you know, when somebody says, you know, I don't know what's going on in my dating life, or I don't know what's going on in my relationships, or maybe they know exactly what their patterns are, but they can't figure out where it's coming from. And then I can pinpoint something back to even when they were a child at home, something they saw, and say, there it is. And all of a sudden, all those dots that seem like these events are, you know, just scattered, all of a sudden you connect them all and they go, oh my gosh, I see it.
Okay, that comes together. Now, you wrote this new book, How to Date When You're Famous. Now, tell us what prompted you to write this book and share some of your delicious stories.
Well, I work with all kinds of clients, and some of the clients I work with are very high-profile celebrity clients. And so one of the needs that they have and the problems that they run into is they don't have a place where they can really feel like they can vent and release and talk about things, because they already have everybody watching them. And it's like, oh, my gosh, where do I go? And so the clients that I work with that have come to me specifically for relationship stuff and dating stuff, I've seen similar things so often that I thought there isn't really anything there. And for people in the spotlight, you know, one of the things that they crave is a sense of normalcy and having, like, that feeling of being able to feel grounded with somebody. And yet there's all this fear, because even with their friends and business associates, everybody wants something from them. And so they get into this feeling, you know, into this place of fear where they're either jumping in with people who just tell them what they want to hear because they figure out what that person's craving, or they're kind of, you know, they're just not having as much fun, and they may even be pushing people away who are great people because they're not giving them enough time to check them out because they're so afraid of what's going to happen and is it going to be the wrong person. So that's one of the big things that I talked about, was how to look at that and also how to take the emphasis off. It's just like we were talking earlier about being bigger than your experiences. And so I knew in my life I couldn't go through my life as a trauma survivor. I had to become Charlie, who happened to also survive a trauma. And for people that are high profile and they're dating, they also have to learn how to not be dating as a celebrity, but be dating as an individual who also happens to be a celebrity. So that's one of the things that I address in the book too, is what are all the things that you need to bring to the table? Because a lot of times a person who says, oh, nobody can see anything but beyond my name, it is actually starting with them. They're not seeing behind this name and this image that they've created. And it's like, if you can't see behind your fame, then no one else is going to be able to see behind it either.
Right. You know, and it's so interesting because you see celebrities out there who seem to handle it so well. They live relatively normal lives. They raise their children. And yet, on the flip side, they're celebrities and their lives are just chaos. How does one navigate that? What advice do you give people when they're just on the verge of becoming a big name?
Right. Well, you know, the funny thing is that in truth, just as you saw, you talked about that sampling in celebrities, it's exactly the same in people who are non-celebrities. We see the same sampling of different kinds of people in different states, you know, with their families.
Mm-hmm.
And as a celebrity, what you have to understand is that everything is going to be magnified.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the public tends to say, well, you have lots of money and you have lots of influence, and so everything's easier. But in truth, there are things that are definitely perks. And yet at the same time, they have to make peace with a few things. They have to make peace with the fact that if they're going into the public eye, there are certain things that are going to happen in certain
mm-hmm.
ways that they're going to be treated. And so they really have to have engage that sense of awareness, because sometimes there's a desire to say, well, I want to simplify my life over here and simplify it over there, because it is kind of chaotic and crazy when you're in the spotlight.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, you actually, your life will be more simplified when you accept that you're in the spotlight and you're going to have to use a certain level of awareness, and you're going to have to put yourself out there in a slightly different way. And yet at the same time, if you own everything you bring to the table and you remove that mystery for people by showing them the other sides of you and not being afraid to do that,
mm-hmm.
then everything does change and the ground becomes a little bit more neutral.
Okay. That's good advice. I'm sure it's very difficult advice for a lot of people. It must be very overwhelming to wake up overnight, so to speak. Of course, no one is a celebrity overnight, as you and I both know. It doesn't happen that way. But to the public, it may seem that way. You were on the E! Channel this year. Tell us about that experience. Was that a fun thing to do?
Oh, that was absolutely wonderful. Because,
uh-huh.
you know, the work that I do, a lot of times people are always trying to figure it out. It's not therapy, and yet I can take somebody and I can totally help them shift from something that's traumatic or something that seems kind of simple but has been holding them back.
Mm-hmm.
And so opening act really gave me an opportunity to showcase the result-oriented approach that I take. And I worked with a musician named Von Smith, who's just a doll. He's
mm-hmm.
absolutely adopted me, and I've adopted him. And he was opening for Lady Gaga in Australia. He's absolutely a phenomenal singer-songwriter and performer.
Uh-huh.
And he was having some major issues at home that stemmed from a relationship with his mother, and there were some religious and cultural differences there, and he was literally freezing up. And they thought, this kid is so talented, and they were so worried that he was going to sabotage this opportunity. So they brought me in to work with him on camera, and
uh-huh.
basically we pinpointed, you know, like 5-6 areas inside an hour and 10 minutes and got not only to the core of it so he could understand and he could really get it, but then we also created strategies, and this is what you got to do and this is how you're going to handle it. And
uh-huh.
I'll tell you, he and I just had lunch last week, and we were talking about how much he and his life have changed in this year. You know, it's been a little less than a year, and he's just
uh-huh.
like, I can't believe it. He's just so wonderful to see. So it was great to be able to do that on TV, but as you can see, I'm getting lost in him, because it was just awesome to do that with him, you know, and see
uh-huh.
his life blossoming.
Oh, how wonderful. Now, you have a new feature on your website, and it's called Raw and Delicious. Tell us about that.
It's about taking the
great.
Raw aspects of life and recycling them into delicious life experiences.
Oh, okay.
So I have tips on there. I'm getting ready to do a whole bunch of feng shui tips. And, you know, the idea is really simplifying things and getting back to the basics, but being real, because I think that's a lot of the reason why people relate to me, because I have so many things, obviously. They're not in my closet anymore. It's more like a big laundry line with everything just kind of hung out there for people to see.
Uh-huh.
But the reality is, this idea that you have to be so perfect and everything has to look this way and be that way, it's just not real. And
okay.
so to be able to embrace who you are, it gives you so much more freedom to actually evolve and become even better and have your life, you know, continue to expand than when you're just trying to pretend like everything's okay.
Okay. Okay. Now, what you're actually advocating is people take the raw situations in their life, the things that you did, the traumatic things, and to turn them around and turn them into delicious experiences.
Yeah, and even just on a simple level, you know, I have a cleanse up there that my girlfriend Kelly and I did, and I have these clips of us, and we literally, and some of them have just woken up, and we are in front of the camera with our hair going in every direction, and we're like, okay, day number three, this is what we ate. You know, it's just about looking at what are the things that we that just make life great, whether it's our diet, whether it's fitness, mm-hmm. whether it's friends, whether it's wine tasting, whatever it is, and just getting back to those basics of really enjoying for enjoyment's sake, because we're just in such a rush these days, and we need to, you know, yes, we have that part of ourselves, but at the same time, we need to honor ourselves too and have more fun and be more present instead of always being in the future with the next thing that we have to get done that we haven't done yet.
Right, right. Now, you're putting yourself out there, and it's very exciting to share this with our listeners. Are you going to be acting again? Is that in your future?
You know what? I might. This is so crazy. I wasn't planning on it. But uh-huh. the thing is that I've met with, you know, even my entertainment attorney was like, why aren't you acting? And then mm-hmm. I met another producer who said, you know, I said, you know what? Why not? After getting, you know, thank goodness you dumped his ass out there and getting this book done, and I'm getting ready to write a third book that I'm really excited about, but I am going to take like 3 days off before I start writing this next book. Uh-huh. And I'm just opening it all up. You know, the thing yeah. is that reality shows are a little bit tough because I have to have that level of quality with the work I do. So if it's going to be introduced as like a caricature, that kind of thing, I won't do it. So, mm-hmm. and yet I love being on camera. So,
yeah.
you know, I'm really pursuing things and being brought in for, you know, spokesperson types of things. And then also people are saying, well, why don't you start acting? And I said, you know what? There's no reason. So we're just yeah. going to see what happens January.
Oh, I'm happy to hear it. I'm looking forward to it. I'm very excited about that. I think you are so talented. You're so beautiful. You should be out there doing more. You should be acting. Now, everyone who's going to look up your book, thank goodness you dumped his ass, use those Mr. Wrongs to lead you straight to Mr. Right. They want to know, did you find your Mr. Right?
You know what? I found a Mr. Right then. And I outgrew him. And that's the honest truth. I actually just ended a 6-year relationship this year, and it was a great relationship, and I grew so much, but it got mm-hmm. to a point where I realized I had really outgrown the relationship. In order to honor him and myself, it was just time to go. So, and that's one of the reasons why I'm getting ready to write the book Love Out of the Box.
Love out of
the
box.
Times, yes, because there are times when we are so centered and you know, really directed toward what we believe is a relationship that's going to go towards marriage, and I really uh-huh. thought this one might.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are other times in our lives where we want other types of relationships, and I really want to bring in that focus on the importance of the experiences we're creating, because people always approach dating as this means to an end. And you've heard the saying, you know, that it's about the journey and not the destination.
Right.
And
right.
we really need to, whether you want a meaningful tryst or you want, you know, modern day matrimony, you have to be thinking about the quality of the experiences you're having with the person you're with, because if you start thinking about it from that place, then no matter which type of relationship you're looking for, they're going to be better.
Right. Well, you know, I love the title, Love Out of the Box. It's a very exciting title for your third book. We have just 2 minutes. Could you share with us, are there any regrets for Charlie Embry?
Absolutely not. There's no regrets are time stealers. So, no, I just look and I go, what can I do with that and how can I use it to propel me forward even faster?
Okay, wonderful. I'm glad to hear that. And what does success mean to you today, right now, as we're speaking?
I think it means peace of mind and passion. You know, really following your passion and being excited and feeling like as much as you want to do out there in the future, that you can actually take a moment and sit down and say, I love my life right now, even with all the things that I want to include and expand. That, to me, is true success.
That is wonderful. Thank you for sharing. Peace of mind and passion. So often I advise my listeners to seek the passion in their life, because once you find something you're passionate about, your life will make sense and what you're doing won't seem like work because it will become your passion. Charlie, you have found so many wonderful experiences this last year. I hope you will keep in touch with us, and definitely let me know when your third book comes out so we can have you on the show to promote it.
You got it.
Oh, wonderful. And good luck with your other two books. And briefly, what is your website?
It is charlieemery.com. That's charlieemery.com.
And I want everyone listening to go to that website. I've been there. It's fantastic. And, Charlie, thank you so much, and we look forward to having you back.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you, January. And, everybody, thank you for listening.
Okay. To our wonderful listeners, we hope you've enjoyed our show today with Charlie. My upcoming guests for the rest of the week are all exciting, energizing, and eclectic. They will amaze, amuse, and they will astonish you. This is the show where you hear inspiring information that will help you to become successful too. I would love to welcome you to our wonderful No Whining world. We love sharing our stories, struggles, and secrets for success. It's our hope that we can encourage all of our listeners to emulate our guests like Charlie today and every day. Remember my mantra, if you think it, then you can do it. So for now, dear friends, please stop whining and then start smiling and then start sharing our success show with everyone you know. And if that doesn't work, then start eating chocolate. Lots and lots of chocolate. Again, thank you to my wonderful guest, Charlie Emery. This is January Jones thanking you for joining me today on my journey and reminding you to take care and stay safe.
We want to thank you for listening to January Jones Sharing Success Stories. Always remember Ms. Jones' personal mantra, if you can think it, you can do it. That's what all of our guests have done with their lives, and so can you. You are the ultimate success coach in your own life. All you need to do will be to start sharing your own story with your family and friends. We hope that our guest stories will encourage you to explore an equation in your future that will combine your creativity, plus connecting with others will enable you to be successful too. Always remember, your passion plus your purpose will equal prosperity as you explore the wonderful world of January Jones.
Yeah, but only one work.
Where's your other boy?
Oh, here.
In the hallway.
I got it up.
No, it's in the hallway.
Honey, I was looking for this other one.
What about that other one?
Have the girls, but she's not going to be here.
What are these cookies for?
I'm taking them over to Nancy. Yeah, we could. Well, we could air at home. This is all coffee stuff. This is her stuff for school. Okay, stuff for school. Is that your one? gotta go get a change. I gotta get a change. With the change,